This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Red Rain by R.L. Stein. Read by Michael Cerveris.
But Zeus sent from heaven a shower of blood-stained rain, in sign of many a warrior's coming doom. The Iliad. Prologue. By morning, the hurricane had passed, but not before destroying every home, every building, every life on the island. Leah lowered her hand from her eyes and waited for them to adjust to the yellow-gray glare. The light reminded her of a sick room, a hospital room, that chilling light that carries no warmth at all. No clouds in the sky, but the sun was hidden, lost behind swirling dust and mist and chunks of dirt that clogged the air. The light feels dirty. Now two dogs began to wail, not in pain, howling a mournful song, sharing the horror of what they saw. Leah took one step, then another, concentrating on keeping her balance. Stay on solid ground. Don't stumble and fall off the edge of the earth into the ragged piles of death. Keep moving and you won't be buried here. Leah's thoughts were a jumble. No way to straighten them out, not with the dogs howling and the children crying and the corpses, all witnesses, all of them, lying so still and watching the living in silent accusation. Her sandals sank into a deep puddle of cold water. She kept walking. Ahead of her, she could hear the rush and roar of the waves. She was walking to the beach without realizing it. The winds and thundering rains had burrowed deep trenches in the sand. Leah stumbled and slogged through them, not seeing them, paying no attention to the mud and wet sand that invaded the bottoms of her jeans and clung like wet plaster to her legs. The sweaty mist carried by the wind off the raging waves didn't revive her. It seemed to blind her even more, as if she were stepping into a whirling, warm cloud, swallowed by it, vanishing. The roar drowned out the howls of the dogs, drowned out everything, even its own sound. A kind of noisy, hollow silence Leah never knew existed. The beach was soaked and soft as quicksand, she thought. And as her sandals sank deep into the muck, she pictured herself sinking down, down, until she disappeared forever into a dark, quiet world. In the water, a canoe bobbed crazily, upside down. Something pale and flimsy tossed on the waves. Was it a sail? A bedsheet? Something crunched beneath Leah's sandal. She stopped with a gasp. She pictured a human hand. Oh no! She lowered her eyes to the sand. Tentacles. A pile of wriggling creatures. She jumped back, struggled to keep her balance. No, they weren't moving. Salt air off the ocean made her eyes water. When she could finally focus, she recognized them. Starfish. Dozens of them. Stiff and already dry. A pile of 100 dead starfish trailed by hundreds more, a long line all down the shore. They must have been washed from the sea by the storm. Leah bent to examine them. She had never seen so many starfish. Never imagined so many would travel together. Travel together to their deaths. She picked one up. Prickly. Nearly as hard as a seashell. She turned it over in her hand. The arm so stiff, as if it had never been alive. She dropped it onto the pile. This has to be a symbol of bad luck. But how can the luck get any worse? She was still leaning down, her eyes trailing the long line of starfish corpses, when she felt the first warm drop on the back of her neck. She brushed it away with the palm of her hand and stood up. A high wave crashed onto the beach, more violent than the others, sending up a spray of white foam before retreating. Leah felt another warm drop, this time on her forehead. She took a step back from the ocean, shoes squishing on the mucky sand. A soft patter made her gaze around. It had started to rain. She felt a few warm taps on the top of her head, another on her forehead. She raised a palm and felt warm raindrops on her skin. Gazing up, she saw only white glare, no rain clouds, but the raindrops made a pit, pit, pit sound on the sand all around her, and the shoulders of her sweater were already wet, and her hair. She uttered a soft cry and squinted into the falling rain. Something strange, something not right, like the dead starfish all gathered in a line on the shore. Something wrong with this rain, the brightness of the sky and the darkness of the raindrops. Very wrong. Leah began to shiver. So unnatural, the darkness of the raindrops. As the storm grew stronger, it became easier to see that the raindrops were red, a shimmering deep scarlet. Holy shit, she murmured. It's raining blood. She raised both palms and watched the red raindrops bounce onto her skin. Fascinated and horrified, she didn't move, stared at her hands as the red drops trickled down her palm. She lifted her eyes to the raindrops falling all around her. Red. As if the blood of all who had died here last night was raining down on her. The blood of all the victims pouring doom over the island, a final, terrifying, drenching goodbye. It soaked her hair and poured down her face. Blood-red raindrops pattering down from a cloudless sky. A blood rain. Where had she heard that phrase before? Yes. She had read about a blood rain in southern India several years ago, for real. The sky had opened up and red rain poured down on a village. And the people were terrified, Leah remembered. They were frightened that the red rain was the onset of the world's end. Now sheets of rain fell, driven by the gusting winds off the ocean. Like red curtains, blowing and parting and closing again. Yes, red curtains of rain all around her. So wrong, so unnatural and wrong. And as the billowing blood curtains appeared to part, two boys came stepping out. Two blonde-haired boys with bright blue eyes, walking solemnly, side by side. Identical blonde boys, wavy hair brushed straight back off their broad, gleaming foreheads, bare-chested and barefoot, wearing only ragged, torn white shorts, stained by the red raindrops. Their faces glowed pink, not a healthy pink, but a reflection of the red rain falling around them. They gazed straight ahead at Leah, unblinking, faces drawn, their expressions stern, wooden, unreadable. Angels, she thought, unable to move, forced to stare back at them. Like blonde angels. Two angels floating out from a curtain of blood and horror. How strange to see these two rays of light appear from all this darkness. Strange even for this island of mystery. Pale chests and arms, white as angel feathers, hands tucked into the pockets of their stained shorts. Glowing figures, they moved in unison, walking together lightly over the soaked sand, blue eyes locked on Leah, closer, until Leah was forced to cut the spell. She blinked a few times. Then, squinting harder at them, she called out, shouting over the roar of the dark rain, "Can I help you?" Part 1, 2 days earlier. Chapter 1. Blog post by Leah Harmon Sutter, travel_adventures.com. April 10. Well, here I am on this island everyone calls mysterious and frightening, and I hope you are as curious as I am to find out if any of the stories are true. I tend to be skeptical. I have a bunch of older brothers who loved making up stories to terrify me, and I quickly learned not to believe any scary story anyone ever told me. I suppose it's odd to begin a travel blog by saying that no one comes here, but before I can begin to describe the unique charms and dark mystique of Cap Le Chat Noir, I really have to start with that fact. No one comes here. Of course, no one really believes the island is cursed, but there are too many frightening stories from its past to ignore. The dozens of Spanish ships that mysteriously sank off the island shores in the 1600s, the rumors of dark magic rituals, the stories that many believe to this day of the living dead walking the island in broad daylight. If you're an adventure traveler like me, those all seem like good things. But the fact is, no one has paid much attention to this island of whitewashed shacks, tall pine forests, fishing villages, and eccentric islanders, despite the fact that you can almost reach out and touch the place from the Outer Banks beaches of South Carolina. Located a hop, skip, and a splash from the Cape Hatteras National Seashore, vacationers have avoided Cap Le Chat Noir like, shall I say it, a black cat crossing their path. For you history nerds, here's the 411. The island was annexed by the English sometime around 1650. They had little interest in it, too small and too far from the mainland. Most English settlers chose the Roanoke colony to the north, and we all know how that worked out. Small groups of nomadic American Indians found their way to the island. Spanish pirates arrived later, sometimes unhappily, because they watched their ships go down just offshore. Yes, this part of the ocean is known as the Graveyard of the Atlantic. You can Google it. Don't bother to look for a reason why all the ships sank. No one can tell you. But this was the beginning of the island's bad reputation. When French traders arrived and heard the stories, they gave the island its unlucky name. I haven't been able to find out what they were trading, most likely rum or some concoction like it. The islanders I've met seem to drink from morning till night, and if that's your idea of travel adventure, go ahead, pack your bags. I've saved the best, or worst, for last. Here's the most interesting historical detail, and it's definitely creepy, especially with frightening forecasts of a big hurricane heading this way. I don't want to talk about the hurricane now. I'm pretending it's not going to happen. You see, Le Chat Noir was devastated by one of the most powerful storms in hurricane history. It was the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, and I have every finger crossed that history is not going to repeat itself now. I heard the story of that dreadful hurricane shortly after arriving at Cap Le Chat Noir and stepping off the bouncing wooden dock. Believe me, folks, it did not exactly make me feel as if a welcome mat had been put out for me. The jeep taxi to take me to my hotel was late. Squinting in the bright sunshine, I glanced around. The dock area seemed to be deserted, except for two ragged-looking fishermen setting off in a tiny flat-bottomed skiff. Definitely no official tourist greeter waiting with a rum punch or even a friendly smile. I spotted a tiny brown shack across the dirt road with the sign Tea Shop, so with suitcase, laptop case, and camera in hand, I made my way there to wait for my ride. Inside, the room was dimly lit, with red neon lights over the mirror at a bar and small glass lamps on each table. The tables were round cylinders like conga drums. Wall posters from tea companies provided the only cheeriness. I liked a poster that showed a grinning Chinese child holding a big steaming cup and the words, "How long since you oolong?" The place was totally empty. I took a seat at a table near the bar. I coughed, hoping it might summon someone from in back. A wooden overhead fan squeaked as it slowly made its rounds. An old woman emerged. White bristly hair under a black bandana, pale skin tight over her cheekbones, silvery gray eyes, little hunched over. She wore a long black dress, not exactly island wear. Without asking, she set a cup of dark tea down on my table with quavering hands. "Thank you." My voice sounded muffled in the heavy air of the tiny room. The squeaking fan seemed to grow louder.
"Why have you come?"
Her voice was velvety smooth, much younger than her looks. Not exactly a friendly hello, huh, folks? I stammered an answer about writing a travel story about Le Chat Noir.
"There's a big storm on the way," she said, "Hurricane Ernesto. Didn't you hear about it?"
She had no accent at all. Her eyes were so glassy I thought she might be blind. But then I remembered she had set the teacup down on the little table with ease.
"Yes, my husband warned me not to come here in hurricane season," I said, inhaling the bitter steam from the cup.
Mark is so sweet. He always wants me to stay home. But exploring my backyard would make for a dull travel blog, don't you agree? Well, to cut to the chase, the woman told me her name was Marguerite.
She procured her own cup of tea, sat down across from me, stared unblinkingly into my eyes, and began to talk in her smooth whisper of a voice.
The hurricane of 1935 didn't have a name. They didn't name them then. But it didn't need a name to be remembered.
I blew on the cup, then sipped the tea. You mean it was a bad one? She nodded. Her throat made a rattling sound. I pretended not to notice.
The storm showed no mercy. It swept over the Outer Banks, up to Chincoteague Island and the Virginia coast, flattening everything in its path. Nothing was left standing on this island. Not a house, not a shack, not a bait shop, not a tea house. All shattered, all ruined. Even the lighthouse on the south shore was toppled over into the ocean.
I tisked. That's horrible.
My friends, people I knew, members of my family, many were crushed, buried, drowned. I was a child. I saw the corpses. They were floating in lakes and rivulets caused by the storm. Even at my age, I knew the horror. I knew the pain, the suffering. No one could decide where to pile the bodies. They lay sprawled in the sand and sea grass and on piles of wreckage, the corpses. They were feasted on for days by seagulls and starving dogs.
She took a long sip of tea. Her throat rattled as she swallowed. She gripped the cup with both hands, I guess because her hands were so shaky. I felt a shiver go down my back. The story was terrifying and sad, but her whispered voice made it even more frightening. I had to remind myself that this took place in 1935.
I was a child, but the pictures never faded from my eyes. The island was devastated, turned to rubble. But it took only weeks to rebuild Le Chat Noir. Why? Because of a miracle. You might not call it a miracle, dear. You might call it a nightmare.
She waited for me to react. Her silvery eyes still hadn't blinked. I set down the cup. What do you mean? What kind of nightmare? She swallowed. She leaned closer, close enough for me to see the thick layer of powder on her tight cheeks.
Le Chat Noir returned to normal in weeks because the old dead, the dead from centuries past, came back to life. All the dead of the island returned to help rebuild it. No eyes, flesh rotting, bones yellowed and broken. They floated up from their flooded graves and went to work. They joined the survivors to bury the recent dead and restore and rebuild Le Chat Noir. When the job was done, did they return to their graves? No. The dead were proud of their handiwork, and they enjoyed the sunlight. It healed them. It made them look almost normal, so normal most of them could blend in with the living. They decided to stay.
I squinted at her. The dead? The dead people stayed? She nodded, her expression solemn. She reached across the table and squeezed my hand. Her hand was dry and hard like solid bone.
That's what makes Le Chat Noir special, dear. It's the only place on earth where the living share their space with the living dead.
I glanced down at my empty teacup. The tea leaves on the bottom appeared to form an X. Of course, I didn't believe Marguerite's story, but it left me feeling strange, kind of cold and tingly. She smiled for the first time. Her smile cracked the powder on her cheeks. Placing both hands on the table, she pushed herself to her feet.
I see you are thinking about my story.
I nodded. Yes, it's frightening. Her smile faded.
Not that frightening, dear. I died 10 years ago, but I'm doing pretty well. Can I bring you another cup of tea?
My mouth dropped open. A dry laugh, more like a cough, escaped her throat.
I'm only teasing you. I see your ride is outside. Enjoy your stay.
on our beautiful island.
Chapter 2. Leah sat on the edge of the bed, smoothing her hands over the tropical-colored flowery quilt, letting the warm sea breezes tickle her face. The lace curtains fluttered at the open window of the rooming house. White and yellow daisies floated in a glass bowl of water on the bed table beside her. The small second-floor room was bright with afternoon sunlight spreading across the blonde wood floor and spotlessly crisp and clean with a vague aroma of coconut in the air. Red and blue starfish dotted the wallpapered walls, appropriate since the place was called Starfish House. The two-story shingled house with a sloping red tile roof stood on a low, grassy dune overlooking the eastern shore beach and a row of white fishing huts along the water.
Is this the calm before the storm? Leah wondered. Or has Hurricane Ernesto changed its course?
She didn't want to check. She didn't want to spoil her first day. She could hear the hushed voices of her hosts drift upstairs from the front desk. An hour before, when the Jeep taxi dropped her off at the front door, they had both come bursting out, clapping their hands and speaking rapidly and excitedly in French, almost dancing around Leah and her two bags.
Maybe they're just warm, excitable people, she thought, but they're really acting as if I'm their first guest.
McCaw Henders and her husband Pierre. They owned the six-room inn. She was a big woman, Spanish-looking, with cocoa skin, round black eyes, and straight black bangs across a broad forehead. She wore an expansive red and fuchsia house dress with feathery sleeves and collar and a red bandana over her hair. Leah had to suppress a laugh since it really did look like bird plumage. In contrast, Pierre was as thin as a pencil, balding, with brown eyes deep-set and a serious face. One of those people who always looks worried, Leah figured. No way to determine how old he was. He could be 30 or 50. A soft knock at the doorway startled Leah from her thoughts. She stood up as Macaw appeared, holding a tray with a white china cup. She handed the cup to Leah. Leah gazed down at a foamy, dark brown drink. She expected the cup to be hot, but it was cold. Macaw smiled, revealing a gold cap on one front tooth.
Go ahead, Madame Sutter. A welcome drink. Take a small sip to start.
She spoke in a lilting sing-song. Leah took a small sip, then another. Coffee with vodka? No, but definitely potent and sour. She could feel the warmth slide down her throat into her chest. Macaw, what is this drink called? The woman hesitated. She ruffled her feathery house dress, much like a preening macaw.
Kill devil,
she said finally, lowering her eyes. Leah laughed and gazed into the cup. Kill devil? Do you know why?
Because it's powerful enough to kill the devil.
Leah took another sip. She was starting to like the bitter taste. This is a lovely room, she said, gesturing with her free hand, and then blurted out without really thinking about it. Am I the only one staying here? The woman nodded. But why? Macaw's smile faded. She pretended to be interested in something on the tray.
I guess they have their reasons, Madame Sutter.
Chapter 3. Blog post by Leah Harmon Sutter. Travel_adventures.com. April 11. The bad news is that Ernesto still has its sights on La Chat Noire. The hurricane is slow-moving, about 14 miles per hour, which is even more bad news because the longer it stays in one place, the more damage it does. The only good news is that it gives me a little time to find some kind of adventure to write about before I have to duck and hide. I'm writing this post on my iPad. I can feel the emergency vibes. People are boarding up their windows and pulling their boats onshore. The sky has turned an ugly lead color, and the wind feels heavy and damp. My hosts, Macaw and Pierre, were reluctant to let me leave the house. I'm not sure they understood that my job is to go out and do risky things so I can write about them. I'd been in touch by email with a woman who lives on La Chat Noire named Martha Swan. Martha told me about an island ceremony called Revenir, which is French for to come back. She explained that the Revenir ritual is part of a practice called Mains Magiques, magic hands. She believed the French traders picked it up somewhere and brought it here with them. Martha wrote that it is a must-see. I told my host I wanted to attend a Revenir ceremony, and they reacted not with horror, but with definite disapproval. They both started shaking their heads as if it would persuade me to drop the idea.
"It's all a fake," McCaw insisted. "They put on a show, the priest, he performs it every week."
"And it's bad for the island," Pierre agreed. His eyes took on a sadness. "These magic rituals, they make us look foolish, primitive."
"Why scare the people away?" Macaw said. "Why not talk about the beauty here, the natural beauty, not the unnatural?"
"I know it isn't real," I said. "I'm not going to write that it's real, but I think my readers will find it interesting. You know, it's all about life and death, right? It's been practiced for hundreds of years. It's so colorful."
"We don't want to be colorful," Macaw said in her red and fuchsia dress.
After a lot of begging and pleading and explaining, they finally agreed to find a guide to take me to the ceremony. He turned out to be a sandy-haired, boyish, tanned young man in khaki cargo shorts and a safari jacket, who seemed so shy and spoke so softly I never did figure out what language he was using. I believe his name was Jean-Carl. He always looked away when he spoke to me, as if he was ashamed of his job or where he was taking me. He drove me in an open jeep over the one single-lane paved road that leads to the center of the island. The road was lined on both sides by amazing cabbage palmettos. Their clusters of long leaves gleamed, even in the darkening light of the sky. Talk about magic. The trees were flowering, the yellow-white blossoms flashing by like tiny lights. I didn't see any other car traffic. Jean-Carl parked the jeep in the shade of a clump of palms at the edge of a sandy path, and we began to walk, the soft sand tickling my feet as it flowed over my open sandals. I tried to ask Jean-Carl questions about what I could expect to see, but again, he seemed embarrassed, or else just painfully unsuited to his job. He kept repeating the word scary and shaking his head. Of course, that only heightened my anticipation, and when we reached a small crowd of people, men and women of indeterminate age in colorful beach caftans and robes, I was ready for my main magique adventure. Chapter 4. Leah estimated 20 people in the crowd, mostly men. They stood at the edge of the thick rainforest inside a circle of the strangest palm trees she'd ever seen. "What are those trees called?" she asked Jean-Carl. He gazed at them, blinking a few times. He didn't answer. What a great guide. I don't think he speaks English. A well-dressed, middle-aged woman with pink cheeks, short blonde hair, and pale blue eyes turned to Leah.
"They're called jelly palms, dear."
Leah studied the very fat trunks topped by long, delicate leaves that looked like feathers.
"Y'all can make jelly from the dates," the woman said.
She had a definite southern accent.
"The dates are big and juicy and very sweet."
Then her eyes went wide.
"Are you Leah from Long Island? I'm Martha Swan."
Leah gasped.
"Martha, really? Hi, how did you recognize me?"
"From your Facebook photo. I feel like we're old friends."
"Wow, I mean, wow, how nice to meet you. See, I took your advice, I'm here. I always think these rituals are a hoot, don't you? They're almost always like from a bad horror movie. I hope I don't burst out laughing."
Martha pursed her lips.
"I don't think y'all will laugh at this one."
She glanced around.
"My husband James and I come often. It's really miraculous. We've even gotten to know the priest."
She raised a finger to her lips.
"Look, I think it's stardom."
Leah turned and stepped forward into the circle of people. They'd gathered around a fallen log, smooth-barked, about 10 feet long. A sun-bleached skull was placed in the center.
"A human skull? No. It's an animal head. A goat, maybe?"
She turned to Jean-Carl to ask, but he had moved away to the other end of the log. She mopped her forehead with the back of one hand. The center of the island felt much steamier than the outer beach areas. She suddenly found it hard to breathe.
"These weird ceremonies make me giddy."
She listened to the buzz of quiet conversations. Two older men in white robes and sandals appeared to be having an argument. A woman in a blue chiffon caftan stepped between them. The crowd grew larger. Now there were maybe 40 people standing in the circle around the log. Leah hadn't seen them approaching. They seemed to have emerged from the trees. She turned and saw 5 people striding quickly on the path. 4 of them were obviously American tourists. The 2 men were paunchy and pale and wore blue and red Chicago Cubs baseball caps. 1 wore a Budweiser t-shirt with a beer can emblazoned across the front. The 2 women with them were slender and dressed in shorts and flowery tank tops. They had cameras hanging around their necks and were being led by a tall, serious-looking guide dressed in khaki cargo shorts and safari jacket like Jean-Carl. Leah was startled. Actual tourists on Cap Le Chat Noir. She had the urge to say hello, to interview them and ask how they came to be on the island and if they knew what this ritual was about, but their guide led them to the other side of the circle. People talked quietly, but the conversations ended when the priest, a tall, bald man wearing a long red robe tied with a yellow sash, stepped out from behind a fat-trunked jelly palm. He had a red face and shocking white blonde eyebrows that moved up and down on his broad forehead like furry caterpillars. His eyes were silvery gray, metallic. He had a tattoo of a blue 5-cornered star on the crown of his bald head, almost big enough to be a skullcap. Weird-looking dude. He stepped into the circle, carrying a long wooden tray. On the tray were coconut halves, flat side up. Without uttering a word, he stepped up to people and raised the tray to them, offering a coconut half. Leah quickly realized that he was approaching only the men in the circle. He handed coconut halves to 6 men. She could see that the insides had been carved to form a cup, and each cup contained a dark liquid. It looked a lot like the Kill Devil drink Macaw had given her when she arrived the day before. Leah felt a chill as the priest eyed her for a long moment. She couldn't read his expression. He flashed her an almost imperceptible smile. Then he moved to the center of the circle and gazed at the men holding the coconut cups.
"It's the black drink,"
Martha murmured in her ear. She leaned close and whispered surreptitiously, as if she was breaking a rule.
"The black drink. Be grateful, dear. In the ceremony, the priest gives it only to the men."
"Why?" Leah whispered back. Again, Martha raised a finger to her lips. Her eyes flashed in the gray afternoon light. She returned her gaze to the priest. Leah glanced down the line to the tourists. All 4 of them were busily snapping photos with their cameras and phones. The red-robed priest gave a signal, and the 6 men raised their coconut cups high above their heads, as if offering them to the sun. They all chanted something in French? Leah struggled to understand. She had studied French for 2 years at Northwestern, but this didn't sound like any French she'd ever heard. When the 6 men finished, the priest chanted for a long time, mumbling to himself and moving his hands slowly in a strange sign language. The sleeves of his robe swayed beneath his bone-slender arms. Leah kept her eyes on his hands. They appeared to take on a life of their own, like small, pale animals floating in the air. Birds uttered harsh cries in the rainforest behind them. A gust of hot wind made the feathery palm leaves slap and scrape. "We need pounding drums here, ominous background music." She scolded herself for being so cynical. The skin on her arms tingled. She wiped sweat off the back of her neck. "The air is so heavy and wet. Perhaps we're feeling the first winds of the hurricane." She crossed her arms tightly on her chest to steady her heartbeat. "I certainly don't want to be out here in the middle of the island if the damned hurricane hits." The priest finally finished his low chant. He nodded. The 6 men lowered the cups to their mouths and drank the dark liquid down. Leah heard soft cries in the crowd, muttered words. The men stood silently, swallowing, even after lowering the cups to their sides. Palm leaves slapped loudly above their heads as if clapping. The sky darkened from pale gray to charcoal. The wind picked up, fluttering robes and skirts, lifting Leah's hair behind her head, making a howling moan as it swirled through the shivering trees.
"Special effects," Leah thought. "The priest chants and the wind starts to howl. Very dramatic."
But she wasn't prepared for what happened next. As she squinted into the fading light, the 6 men all began to groan. They coughed,
and rolled their eyes. Their faces reddened. They bent their knees and knelt. Bending low, faces purple, they uttered hideous choking sounds, then rasping moans from deep in their throats. Their stomachs bubbled and heaved, and they all began to vomit at once. Chapter 5. Groaning, moaning, bleeding like sick sheep, all six men heaved together. At first they spewed a dark liquid, and then the chunky orange and yellow of their undigested lunches. Hands on their knees, heads bowed as if praying, they puked their guts out in a chorus of animal groans and splashing liquid. Leah grabbed her throat. She felt her breakfast rise. Her stomach churned. She held her breath, swallowing hard, swallowing, struggling not to heave along with them. This was no act. They weren't faking it. No one could fake those ugly sounds, those horrified expressions. She covered her ears from their choked gasps and bleats and retching moans. The sour smell rose into the humid air and swept over her. She stared at the thick piles of yellow-green vomit spreading puddles on the sand. Still holding her breath, Leah started to turn away. But Martha held her by the shoulders. "It isn't over. It just started." "Just started?" A shudder ran down Leah's body. Her legs suddenly felt rubbery, weak. She forced herself to watch. The six men bleated and choked. They grabbed their throats. Their eyes bulged in panic. Their faces darkened from red to purple to a sick blue. She cried out as the men collapsed to the ground. One by one, they folded up, coiling into themselves. Uttering strangled sighs, they dropped face down into their own vomit. They sprawled awkwardly on the ground, eyes bulging, gazing blankly. Their arms and legs twitched as if they were getting electrical shocks, twitched like grotesque puppets that had lost their strings, then stopped. No one moved. Swaying in the gusting wind, the feathery palm trees slapped and applauded. The birds had stopped their shrill symphony. The red-robed priest knelt beside one of the fallen men. The star tattoo on his scalp appeared to wriggle, alive, like a blue octopus. He placed two fingers on the man's throat. Minutes went by. "Il est mort," announced in a whisper. "Oh my God," Leah murmured. She suddenly realized she had been hugging herself tightly for some time. Down by the tight circle of onlookers, she heard the startled cries of the four tourists. No one else made a sound. The priest moved to the next victim, sprawled face down on the sand, a young man with short red hair and a boyish, freckled face. He rolled the man onto his back. After a brief examination, the priest repeated the words, "Il est mort," flat. No emotion at all. Leah turned and saw the two men tourists snapping photos with their phones. The women had their hands over their faces, blocking out the death scene. "Is this for real?" the man in the Budweiser shirt boomed. "Hey, are they really dead?" No one replied. All eyes were on the tall, bald priest until he knelt over the last of the six victims.
"Tous sont morts."
Leah forced herself to breathe. She suddenly felt dizzy, the blood pulsing at her temples. She had hoped to write about travel adventures people would find exciting, but no way she wanted to watch six men drink poison and vomit themselves to death. Squinting into the graying light, she could see clearly that the six men weren't breathing. Their chests showed no movement, no rise and fall, no movement at all. Their eyes bulged, gazing blankly like glass doll eyes. Their mouths hung open, frozen in their final gasps for breath. Still, no one on the island moved or made a sound. She glimpsed Jean-Carl across from her in the circle. He had his head down, hands jammed into the pockets of his cargo shorts. The tourists had stopped their picture-taking. One of the women was crying. Budweiser man wrapped her in an awkward hug. The priest, still expressionless, turned to face the crowd. His blonde caterpillar eyebrows had gone stiff and still. He clasped both hands in front of him. Leah noticed for the first time that his fingernails were painted black. He began to chant,
"Revenir, revenir, Revenir.
Softly at first, then louder, urging the audience to join in.
Revenir, revenir, revenir.
The chanting voices echoed off the trees of the rainforest. The chant continued for 2 minutes, three. Leah screamed when she saw a hand move. On the ground, fingers twitched.
Revenir, revenir, revenir.
The chant continued, no longer a word, just a low, breathy sound. Another dead man blinked his eyes. Another raised his head an inch off the ground. A short groan escaped his throat. More hands twitched, like crabs testing the sand.
Revenir, revenir, revenir.
As Leah stared in disbelief, the six men sat up. They blinked rapidly and shook their heads, tested their jaws, squinted at the chanting crowd. The chant ended suddenly. People rushed forward to help the men to their feet. In seconds, they were all standing, taking small steps, still looking dazed, wiping chunks of vomit off their shirts and shorts and robes. The priest raised his hands high above his tattooed head.
Les hommes sont revenus,
he announced. The men have returned. The six men were walking steadily now, making their way to the path. The circle of onlookers broke up, people heading in all directions. Leah listened to the excited conversations. Some people were laughing. The ceremony was over. Leah shut her eyes. Again, she pictured those men bent over, their streams of vomit splashing onto the grass, their gasping, terrified faces, their bodies coiled lifelessly on the ground in front of her. And as rain began to patter down, she thought of the 1935 hurricane and the story of the dead returning to life to repair the devastating damage, the living sharing their space with the unliving. Huge raindrops rattled on the palm leaves, like assault rifles, loud as thunder. The wind swirled around Leah, pushed her right, then left. She planted her feet, determined not to be blown over. A suffocating wind rushed over her face, made her gasp for breath. It came on so suddenly, I thought we had time. Hugging herself again, she ducked her head and searched for Jean-Carl. Nowhere in sight. Perhaps he had run to the jeep. A strong blast of wind bent the palm trees till they were nearly horizontal. Leah's shoes sank into the mud as she stepped onto the path. She felt a hand on her shoulder. Gasping in surprise, she spun around. Martha? Martha had a canvas tennis hat pulled down tight over her hair. Her sweater was already soaked through, matted to her body. Better come home with me, she had to scream over the roar of the wind. Leah blinked through the sheets of rain that swept over her. No, my stuff.
Better come with me, Leah. This is gonna be bad. It's gonna be real bad.
Chapter 6. As Hurricane Ernesto slowly made its way north, Mark Sutter was ending his book tour close to home at Hampton Books in East Hampton, Long Island. The store occupied a gray shingle building near one end of the long row of shops on Main Street, a few doors down from the Ralph Lauren store, a country antique store, an old-fashioned toy store, and the Hamptons branch of Tiffany's, all closed and deserted on this rain-tossed April night before the summer people had arrived. Mark arrived early, shaking out his umbrella and squirming out of the Burberry trench coat that no longer seemed to be waterproof. He liked to watch his audience come in, liked to size up the crowd before he spoke to them. Crowd? Would there be a crowd on a night like this? He saw a few rain-bedraggled people in one of the long, narrow store aisles. A good sign. A smiling middle-aged woman hurried out from behind the front counter to greet him.
Hi, Mr. Sutter. I'm Joanne, the manager. Welcome. You're early.
She was a mouse of a woman, small and gray, with lips the same color as her skin. She was probably 40, but she looked 10 years older. She wore a loose-fitting gray turtleneck over black corduroy slacks. I like to come early and hang out a bit, Mark said. You know, chat with people, kind of size up the crowd.
Well, make yourself at home. We've already sold several books, and we got a lot of phone calls. I think there'll be a crowd,
she squinted at him.
How does it feel to be controversial?
Mark laughed. I'm enjoying it, actually. She nodded solemnly.
Of course you are. Mark wondered exactly what she meant. "Sometimes it's good to stir people up," she said, and then quickly changed gears. "Can I get you a bottle of water?" "No, I'm fine." "Sure? I have plenty of water." "No, really, I saw enough water driving here." His joke fell flat. He knew it wasn't much of a joke. He shouldn't try to be funny. No one expected it of him. But what was this obsession with water? In every city, at every bookstore, they tried to shove bottle after bottle of water at him. "The rain is from the hurricane," she said, "but we're lucky. I have the radio on. They said it's veering out into the ocean. We'll just get the rain." "Hurricane?" She squinted at him. "You didn't hear? It's a big one, down south." Mark felt his throat tighten. "My wife is down south, on an island. I didn't know. I had my iPod in the car. Maybe you should try to call her." She turned and saw the line of customers at the front counter. "I'd better get back." She gave his wrist a quick squeeze, like saying, "Good luck." Then she turned and made her way to the other two clerks at the counter. She stepped behind one of the cash registers and pulled on a pair of tight white rubber gloves to protect herself from money germs. Mark slid his BlackBerry from the pocket of his jeans, raised it to push Leah's number, then stopped. No bars. "I'm sure she's okay. I'll phone her after the book signing." He stepped toward the back and leaned against a bookshelf where he could watch customers enter. He could see a gauzy reflection of himself in the front window, floating over the pyramid of display copies of his book. A gust of wind rattled the window and sent rivulets of rainwater streaking down the glass. "Where do I put this?" A man in a brown rain slicker and canvas tennis hat shook his umbrella in a red-haired store clerk's face, sending a spray of rainwater over the front counter. The young man pointed to the tall can by the door, already jammed with wet umbrellas. The store was small, narrow and deep, with two aisles leading back through tall wooden bookshelves. Rows of low-hanging fluorescent lights sent down a pale glare, making everyone look a little green. At the back, a steep stairway led upstairs to the author event area. Mark felt his skin prickle. He rubbed his stubbled cheeks. The air in the store felt hot and damp despite the cold blasts every time the door opened. He could smell the ocean. "In a few hours, I'll be home." He could hear a low mumble of voices from upstairs. A respectable crowd on a stormy Wednesday night in East Hampton.
"Please, let there be 50 people. That's all an author cares about, a crowd big enough not to be embarrassing. Please, not 4 people who all choose to sit in the back row."
To his relief, he saw several couples lined up at the cash register. They all had his book in their hands. Did they look happy? No.
"They've all come for a fight."
He turned back toward the front door and felt his stomach rumble, not from stage fright. He looked forward to another confrontation. If only he could keep them from shouting this time. He suddenly pictured the young woman in Boston who turned purple and started to tremble. That was awkward. And the angry couple who followed him to the parking lot and refused to let him get into the car until they had their say. His stomach churned again from the bacon cheeseburger he had eaten too fast at Rowdy Hall, the noisy, crowded hamburger joint across the street. He always ate too fast when he was alone.
"I'll be home tonight."
His house in Sag Harbor was 20 minutes away, maybe a little longer if the storm continued. He had driven to the bookstore directly from MacArthur Airport in Ronkonkoma. He hadn't had even 2 seconds to stop at home and say hi.
Ira and Elena.
When did he see them last? 2 weeks ago? He talked to them on the phone every night, and he Skyped them when he could, but the conversations were always forced and hurried. Elena was okay. Even at the gawky age of 14, she bobbed merrily through life like a kite in a strong wind. Ira was the sensitive one, always overthinking everything, so shy and serious. Poor guy. 6th grade. His first year in middle school. Mark should have been there to help him get through it. Or Leah. But she was away too. He hated it when they were both away at the same time.
"When you write a travel blog, you kind of have to travel," Leah had said.
"I'm not accusing you of anything," he had countered. "I'm just saying that one of us should stay home." "No, I'm just saying it's a shame that one of us isn't staying home." That made her laugh.
"I love your subtle distinctions. I wasn't a psych major like you, darling, but I know when I'm being guilted."
Guilted? No way he could convince her to stay home till he got back. Travel and leisure had let her go. Budget cutbacks, the usual thing. Now, Leah was determined to produce the best adventure travel blog in the universe, build a huge audience, collect millions in advertising, and show her old bosses what a mistake they had made. She was ambitious, and she was a fighter. The youngest of seven, with four brothers and two sisters, Leah was used to fighting for what she wanted. And so, they went their separate ways, and Mark's sister Roz stayed with the kids. Mark had to admit the 10-city book tour was not as glamorous as he had imagined, and he was taken by surprise by all the anger waiting for him at every bookstore. After all, he'd only written a book. He hadn't murdered anyone. He wasn't naive. He knew his book would spark controversy, but he never dreamed that parents would react with such alarm as if he were threatening parenthood itself, which maybe he was. Because of all the controversy, Kids Will Be Kids was at the top of the nonfiction bestseller list, exactly what he had strived for. He wanted to reach as many parents as possible. He wasn't trying to become famous by stirring things up. He believed his studies of his young patients validated his parenting theories. He glanced at the clock, then watched more rain-soaked stragglers push into the bookstore. Someone tapped his shoulder. The red-haired store clerk, Adam, it said on his ID badge.
Mr. Sutter, can I get you some water?
No, thanks. I'm good.
You sure?
He turned to the steep wooden staircase. He could hear the crowd up there shifting, folding chairs squeaking, the mumble of voices. Someone laughed loudly. Showtime. Chapter 7. Not quite ready. He made his way toward the bathroom behind the office and back. A large man in a gray hoodie and faded jeans blocked the aisle. He was scanning a shelf of fiction, but turned as Mark approached.
Hi, you here for my book talk?
The man shook his head.
No, I'm not much of a reader. I'm here for my wife.
Your wife?
Yeah, she heard there's a new James Patterson.
He swung back to the bookshelf.
You're not him, are you?
No, I'm not. Sorry. Sorry? Why'd I say sorry? Mark edged past him into the phone booth-sized bathroom and checked the mirror, brought his face close and grinned. He rubbed his front teeth with one finger. No hamburger or lettuce there, nothing hanging from his nose. He smoothed a hand over the stubble on his cheeks and brushed back his short hair, his hazel eyes dark in the dim light from the ceiling. He wasn't admiring himself. He was preparing himself. Leah called him Gyllenhaal. She said he was a dead ringer for the actor. Flattering?
Yes.
A two-day stubble, short dark hair, and big eyes. And he was Jake Gyllenhaal to her.
I love you, Leah.
Only 39, but even in this bad light, he could see patches of gray spreading over the sides of his hair. No problem. A psychologist doesn't want to be too good-looking. He needs some maturity, some authority. He wore a trim black suit over dark, straight-leg denim jeans. His white shirt was open at the collar. Not too formal. He wanted to appear open and friendly. They would see he wasn't a stuffed shirt. He was a young father, a child psychologist with a serious point of view, but casual, even likable. He grinned. He should wear a suit of armor. The lions were waiting upstairs to rip into shreds and devour the remains. His stomach churned again. Maybe it wasn't the cheeseburger. Maybe it was the two Heinekens.
Up the stairs, Mark. Go get 'em.
He used the wooden banister to pull himself. The steps creaked beneath him. He practiced a smile. It didn't feel right. Tried a smaller one. Above the mumbling of the crowd, he could hear rain pattering against the sloped skylight window in the ceiling. The stage area came into view as he reached the top. A good crowd. The folding chairs were all filled, and a row of people stood behind them. Some leaned against the bookshelf walls. Two young women had made cushions of their coats and sat cross-legged on the floor to the side of the podium. At least 100 people. No, more like 150. So far, a success. Joanne flashed him a smile from beside the podium. Good. The store manager was pleased. He surveyed the crowd. Mostly couples, parents. Some gripped his book in their laps. To have it signed or to throw at him. They watched him warily as he moved toward the podium.
He's young,
someone whispered just loudly enough to be heard.
Does he have kids? If he does, can you imagine what they're like?
A cell phone erupted and was quickly cut off. He saw three very old people, frail, hunkered in the front row, still in their raincoats, shopping bags on the floor in front of them. Regulars, probably. Lonely people who come to every bookstore event. Joanne started to introduce him. There were hurried footsteps on the stairs, more arrivals. She wrapped her hand around the microphone as she talked, and it made an annoying scraping sound.
Already seem to be familiar with our guest author and his book, so I expect a lively discussion tonight.
Mark heard a few people snicker at that.
Some things you may not know about Mark Sutter, Joanne continued. He's a Sag Harbor resident, not a summer person. He and his wife live here year-round with their two children.
She read from a handwritten index card. One hand held the card. The other squeezed the microphone as if trying to get juice from it.
Mr. Sutter was born on Long Island in 1973. He grew up in Great Neck. He has a B.S. in child psychology from the University of Wisconsin. Mr. Sutter has a national reputation. He has contributed to many major psychology and science journals. Kids Will Be Kids is his first book based on studies he made over the past 5 years observing his own juvenile patients and their parents.
She finally let go of the microphone and motioned to Mark with a tight smile.
Let's all welcome tonight's author, Mark Sutter.
Tepid applause. Mark forced the practiced smile onto his face and took two steps toward the podium. Joanne turned and wrapped her hand around the microphone again. The applause died quickly. She waved Mark back.
Oh, I almost forgot, she said, while I have you all here. Such a nice crowd. It's so wonderful to see people come out on a rainy night to discuss books.
Mark shoved his hands into his jeans pockets and waited. He studied the crowd. A 20-something couple in the second row had their heads down, tapping away on their phones. Behind them, a large man in a Yankees cap and blue and white Yankees jacket had the Daily News open in front of him. Rain pattered the skylight window. Mark glimpsed a flicker of lightning high in the green-black sky. He blinked and saw someone he recognized in the third row, a young woman in a short blue skirt over black tights and a white tube top. His eyes took in the gleaming white blonde hair, blue eyes, high cheekbones, red-lipped smile. She didn't register at first, mainly because she didn't tell him she'd be there. The improbably named Autumn Holiday, his assistant. She realized he had finally spotted her. She smiled and her eyes went wide. She gave him an excited wave. Why did she get all dolled up for this? Autumn always showed up at his office in jeans and oversized Rock Band t-shirts, her hair tied carelessly back in a ponytail. Now he couldn't help but stare. She looked like one of those stunning Nordic ice queen fashion models.
Autumn? What are you doing here?
He mouthed the words silently.
Thriller night here at Hampton Books, Joanne was saying. I think you'll all want to be here. Our guest author will be Harlan Coben, and if you were here last year, I'm sure you will remember how funny and charming Mr. Coben can be. So don't forget next Saturday night.
Mark forced himself to turn away from Autumn. Joanne was waving him back. This time there was no applause. He could feel the tension in the room. Lightning flickered in the skylight above. People shifted their weight, sat up straighter, squeezed the books in their laps. The couple in the second row tucked their phones away. Somewhere in the back, a baby cried. Mark suddenly realized there were several babies on laps, swaddled like tiny mummies. Mark placed his hands on the sides of the podium. The microphone was a little too low. He leaned into it.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out on such a lovely night. Instead of a reading tonight, I know you all probably have a lot of questions, and I thought we could begin by discussing...
Several hands shot up. They were too eager.
Here we go again.
Are you Dr. Sutter or Mr. Sutter?
From a chubby, coppery-haired man standing behind the seats, wearing an ugly chartreuse turtleneck and gray sweatpants.
I'm Mr. Sutter. I have a B.S. degree in child psychology. You can call me Mark.
So you're not a doctor,
accusing. Before Mark could answer, a woman in the front row, her arm cradling a swaddled baby. Why do you think children don't need parents? Why do you think they should grow up wild and undisciplined and untrained? Mark forced his smile to grow wider. He had learned a lot at the other bookstore appearances. The trick was not to get flustered. Remain calm, be quieter and saner than the audience. He glimpsed Autumn, her brightly lipsticked lips pursed, eyes narrowed with concern. Have you read my book? He asked the woman in the front row. She nodded. Some of it. A few people snickered. Well, I think you are misrepresenting what I wrote. I believe children need parents, he said. My problem is with too much parenting.
There can't be too much,
a man yelled from somewhere in the back. The outburst drew some short applause. Mark ignored it. Basically, what I have found is that children thrive and grow happier and more creative with less parental supervision. I'm not saying we should ignore our responsibility to teach them the basics of what's right and wrong. We all must instill a good moral sense, but we all know about helicopter parents these days who hover over their kids wherever they go. These control freak parents hinder the natural creative growth.
Kids need to be controlled,
the same man shouted. Kids want to be controlled, the woman with the baby contributed. They don't want the kind of freedom you are talking about. The audience seemed to erupt. Mark kept his smile, waited for them to settle down, tapping his hands on the side of the podium. I appreciate your point of view, he said finally, but for my book, I studied my patients and their parents for 5 years. My observations led me to believe what I wrote here. I believe parents should act like guides, but not like cops. Children need their parents to be warm and loving, but they also need to be independent from them. The woman with the baby spoke up again.
You mean parents should act like friends, not like parents?
Friends love and support you, Mark replied. What's wrong with that? Another eruption of angry voices. Autumn was shaking her head, her hair shimmering like a silver helmet in the light. She stared at him wide-eyed, concentrating as if sending him a psychic message of support. His one fan. She has nice tits. How come I've never noticed? Because she's 23? Let me give you an example from the book, the boy named Sammy. Sammy is 10. His parents treat him as an equal. They let him decide what to eat. They let Sammy decide when to go to bed and when to wake up. They let him decide how much time to spend playing video games or watching TV. As a result, Sammy is not only happy, but well-behaved, mature. He has a confidence that I don't see in most 10-year-olds. You see, the extra freedom given Sammy by his parents has allowed him to... A vibration against his leg stunned him, and he stopped in mid-sentence. It took him until the second buzzing tingle to realize it was the phone in his jeans pocket. Probably his sister Roz wanting to know when he'd be home. He ignored it. It buzzed 3 more times before it shut off.
A lot of doctors don't agree with you,
a woman against the wall spoke up in a raspy smoker's voice.
I read a review by a psychologist in the Times who said your ideas are dangerous.
The phone buzzed again. The vibration sent a tingle up and down his leg. Roz wouldn't call back. Someone was being insistent. Excuse me, he said, grabbing the phone from his pocket. He squinted at the screen. Leah? I'm really sorry. I have to take this. He backed away from the podium. My wife, she's on an island. He turned away from the audience. Behind him, mumbled voices and grumbling. He raised the phone to his ear. Leah, are you okay? A deafening howl made him jerk the phone away. Then he heard her voice, high, shrill.
Mark, the hurricane!
He could barely hear her over the static and whistling.
What? What did you say? Ernesto, it's horrible, Mark!
She was screaming over the roar. She sounded frantic.
The hurricane? Are you okay?
The howling stopped. A jarring silence. He pressed the phone to his ear so hard it hurt.
Leah, are you there? Leah!
Chapter 8. Mark's hand trembled as he set the phone down on the podium. His whole body tensed. He tried to swallow, but his throat had closed up. She sounded terrified.
He kept his eyes on the phone. Call back, call back, call back, Leah. The baby in the front row started to cry. The woman shifted it in her lap and stuck a plastic pacifier in its mouth. The crowd had grown quiet. Maybe they could sense that he was shaken. He found a bottle of water on the shelf inside the podium, twisted it open, and took a long drink. Sorry about the interruption. He stared at the phone. My wife is on a tiny island off the Carolinas. I think she's in the hurricane. We were cut off. He raised his eyes to the skylight. Waves of rain rolled over the glass. Joanne leaned against the bookshelf on the wall, arms crossed tightly in front of her sweater. Her eyes were closed. Where were we? Mark tried to start again. They slumped in their seats now. The tension had gone out of the room. It was as if he had absorbed it all. His mouth felt dry. He tasted half-digested cheeseburger in his throat. He took another swig of water to wash it back down, spilled some on his shirt. Call back, call back. I know what people call me. They say I'm the opposite of the tiger mom. They call me the teddy bear dad. That got a few snickers. The crowd seemed to relax just a little. But I'm not talking about no parenting. My idea is less parenting. The examples in my book show that children can be nurtured without being bossed, guided without realizing they are being guided. My theory is that parents who are friends to their children will be friends for life and will not encounter an explosion of thunder close enough to rattle the skylight window, ended that thought. The lights flickered. A few people gasped and cried out. This was a problem of living on Long Island's East End. The power lines were all strung through the trees. He wondered if Route 114 was flooded. The drive home could be longer than he had hoped. He was talking without really hearing himself, wishing he could wrap it up, sign their books, go home, and try to reach Leah. But they had come with questions, and he couldn't cheat them of a chance to spout their disapproval.
Do you raise your own children this way? Are you always their friend and not their father?
Can you tell us some first-hand examples of parents who tried your way? Didn't some of the kids become spoiled brats, total monsters?
You really think kids should be raised like wild animals? Were you raised by wolves?
That question was greeted by laughter. It made Joanne open her eyes and seemed to break the tension. Mark let out a long breath. A good place to end. He thanked everyone for their opinions and for coming out on such a dreadful night. He could sense disappointment. They had come for the kill, but he was too distracted to do battle. They hadn't even wounded him. About half the crowd left, funneling down the creaking stairway without having a book signed. Those who lined up for his autograph were quiet and polite, except for a small, frail-looking woman in a ragged gray trench coat who glared at him through square spectacles and said, "You could do a lot of harm with this book." She then asked him to sign the book. "To Megan." By his count, he sold 30 or 40 books. When the last customer, the man in the Yankees gear, made his way to the exit, Joanne patted his shoulder.
Good job, Mark. That wasn't easy.
He sighed. This is my last stop on the tour. Now I'm going to stay home for a while. The phone, secured in his jeans pocket, remained a silent hunk of metal and plastic. Scenes of Cap Le Chat Noir rushed through his mind, fragments of photographs Leah had emailed him. He saw the wide yellow beach, fishing boats bobbing in the calm water offshore, small, square, white cabins with red clay roofs.
Your raincoat is in the office. I'll get it for you.
Joanne made her way to the stairs. Mark stood up, then froze for a second, surprised to see Autumn lingering near the back row of seats. She had a shiny, violet-colored slicker folded over one arm. She smiled and hurried toward the podium. I didn't expect to see you here, Mark said. She giggled. I wanted to support.